Cinnabar Moss, or any kind of moth you'd like to be. Welcome to the Writer's Triangle, Cinnabar Moss podcast about all things publishing and books. Today we are here with Robert Creekmore of the Prophet's Death Trilogy. Book 2, Prophet's Lamentation, is our July release. Robert, how are you doing today?
Most excellent, sir. Most excellent. That's the thing. Prophet's Death Trilogy. And having books with similar names, it's really easy to get them mixed up. I do it myself all the time. I start talking about one book and I'm like, oh no, it's named this. And so, you know, got this trilogy of books. It's Prophet's Debt, Prophet's Lamentation, Prophet's Death. And it's all a big mouthful, so I just call it the Prophet's Debt series.
Okay. Yeah, I made a bit of a mistake there as well, because death and debt are so close, and, you know, we have talked about Prophet's Debt as well, so it's just kind of on the mind a little bit.
Oh, no, but totally. Like, oh, don't feel bad. That, like, I do it. I do it all the time. Talking about it and writing about it. I have written emails about a book, and the entire email is me talking about this book, but using the wrong name. And I think that kind of plays into when you have a trilogy and you've lived in this world for so long, it all starts kind of running together, because while my trilogy is 3 books, it's really, to me, one big story, you know, because it all lives in my head, because it all comes out of my head, and there's no delineation between the last page of the book before and the first page of the next book. It's, to me, all one big book.
Yeah, I think that when you write a world, right, and you write these mm-hmm. stories in that world, in your mind, it's just, this is the story of these characters from this point to this point. And then, you know, just because of how books work, you have to kind of cut it up a little bit. But that's just to give it to other people to experience. But in your head, it goes from A all the way to the end at Z. And there's no stops along between them.
It is. And to me, though, you know, I was thinking about this the other day. In my opinion, stories never really end. There's no real happy ending and everybody rides off into the sunset. It's never really, really like that in real life. You still have to wake up the next day and go to work or whatever it is you do, just exist. And, you know, in love stories, it to me, it's always kind of silly when it's like, and they lived happily ever after, you know, I'm like, well, no, they probably got in an argument a week later. And, right. You know, then had marriage counseling and, you know, like the vicissitudes of life, they happen. And so, you know, you have, when you write a book, you have to put those in there and make it realistic. And I never really think about my story in characters might end, characters might die, but the story continues on. Just like when I die, the world won't end. The world right. will keep going, won't it? So I feel like my universe goes on until I end. And then in my head, I think about, what would those characters do? What will they do? Will I ever write that? I don't know. You know? We'll see. I never know until the voices tell me to write something.
I think that's a very good point, is that these stories are, you know, living in our minds, right? And so with the upcoming book, the second book in the series, Prophet's Lamentation, you're continuing on taking the readers on this journey that you've already experienced in your own mind. And are you feeling excited about the release of the second book in the series and the journey that you're taking people on with Naomi and her chosen family?
Of course. Of course. I'm always happy to offer up a sacrifice to them, to the readers, and go, okay, be gentle. Take my characters, take my creation, and enjoy it. And so I'll always feel that way. Even if I'm writing a short story, and handing it to my friend, and it never goes anywhere else. You know, I'm excited to bring that character to life. You know, and when you write and you get really, really into it, you know, and you write every day, and I tend to write almost every single day. I sit down, I have a schedule. You start at the beginning thinking, what would my character do? Okay, I take this character, these are their personality traits, and I put them in this situation, what would they do? After you've written characters long enough, the same character, you start having this weird kind of premonitions where they start becoming kind of real to you, and you start thinking, I wonder what my character's doing right now. And you have to stop yourself and go, you know, they're not real. I mean, but maybe they are. They're part of who you are. They're part of who you are. So, you know, what would you think they would be doing right now? But that's just kind of the creative process to make something real. It has to become real to you.
Yeah, I do think that there is a certain level of realness that has to be involved in it, because you are trying to write in a sense, authentic stories, right? Even if it's fiction, there still has to be that kind of that layer of reality to it to ground people in the story and to make it something they can connect to and bond to. And one of the best ways to doing that, if not the best way, is to have your characters feel genuinely human, if they're human, you know.
Even then, sentience is sentience.
Right.
So, you know, the possibility of life that isn't human, but sentient, I think counts up there as well. Your aliens or your very intelligent animals, like your cetaceans or something like that, I think they qualify to some degree in that area, or AI, and not in the ChatGPT type AI. I mean, like literal self-aware, holy crap, I hope they don't kill us type AI. Right. there's personhood to that too. I mean, once we actually get there, I don't know if I want to, but I don't have any say-so. So I just have to deal with what gets dealt to the world, just like everybody else. But there's the thing is, like, okay, so you can have all these characters. Like, my character has supernatural abilities, and that's obviously not real. But it's not about that. It's a vehicle to understand the human experience, condition, and relationship between human beings. It's in a lot of times the books are really just that. They are about the people and their conversations, and their conversations about the things that happen, not necessarily about what happens at all, because there are entire books that are just completely conversational. Franny and Zoe comes to mind. Just the entire book's conversation. You know, nothing really happens. But it's one of the most beloved books of the 20th century.
So. Yeah, I definitely agree with you. I do feel that your writing as well has that sense of, you know, the conversations and the experiences of these people in these situations, and you know, there's the magical powers and things that are supernatural in their way that wouldn't be real in our world, but those are less the focus than the journey that Naomi is taking, right?
That's right.
And so that's right. For those of us who haven't read Prophet's Debt book one, could you give us a bit of a summary of that so people can understand kind of the first leg of Naomi's journey?
Well, first things first, how detailed? Because if you're not familiar with my work, I have had someone, more than one person, who are a fan of the first book, who have told me that they vomited when they read the book. One person was like, I retched, I almost vomited. So the details of the book are fairly graphic. How detailed do you want me to get?
I think for this, maybe we could just give them a general summary, and we can let them experience the details when if/when they choose to read it and really experience for themselves. I think that those things, when they're brought together in your writing, have a really profound effect that I think might get lost if we just give them a summary version of it, right?
That, and I have actually leaned away from reading things like that aloud to people, because I feel like on the page is one thing, out of my mouth is almost aggressive and terrifying. So I'll bring you up to speed with Naomi. Prophet's Debt, which is book one, 1994. Excuse me, 1993. Naomi is 14 years old, because I'm mixing up the numbers, 3 and 4. In 1993, Naomi is 14 years old. In first grade, she met Tiffany. Her and Tiffany have gone to school together. They're best friends, both kind of outcasts. More Tiffany than Naomi, because Naomi has always been very tall and strong, and you don't really want to fuck with her. Even in, you know, fifth grade, she'd probably kick your ass. So she's kind of what I would describe as the bully's bully, you know, who kind of person who sticks up for the kid who gets picked on. And but they're both very intelligent, and I would call them gifted. Both of them are fairly intellectually gifted and have no interest in the kind of sports and mainstream things, which is fine if you're into sports, football, whatever. There's nothing wrong with that. It comes into play being a problem is when other people expect you to be into it and then find a novelist that you're not into it and give you a hard time. So they spend a lot of time together reading, going fishing, and doing all the country girl things that we do around here in North Carolina. And eventually they figure out they're not just friends. They are, in fact, in love. And they have physical feelings for one another. And in August of 1993, I believe it's the 12th, the Perseid meteor shower peaks. And they're both very interested in science, specifically Naomi. And Tiffany's more of a literature person. They go to a park to watch the meteor shower. They kiss for the first time. And first time any of them had really felt anything beyond just, you know, there's a physical manifestation of love, anything beyond just camaraderie and affection, but physical love. And the sister of Tiffany catches them and completely goes berserk and starts hurting Tiffany, because she's trying to drag her away. And Naomi has always been very protective of her, because Tiffany has been all short of stature her entire life. And she grabs the accosting sister's arm and tells her to stop and starts twisting her arm. And she's surprised, because she's forgotten, just because Naomi's younger than her, she's not bigger and stronger. And she does. But because she is who she is, and because the accosting sister has been horrible to Tiffany her entire life, Naomi breaks her arm anyway. And after that, they go on the run, but it's not long before they're caught by Tiffany's parents and Naomi's parents. Tiffany's dad beats her until she's unconscious, and she never sees Tiffany. Well, I won't say again, but she doesn't see Tiffany again for a very, very, very long time, years and years. She is taken home, chained to a bed, and her parents go off somewhere. She doesn't know where that is. And she's left there with the pastor and the pastor's wife. And she is completely a prisoner, I mean, to the point of having to use a hospital toilet beside the bed with one arm chained to it, because they're afraid she's going to escape. And they're all kind of this very dogmatic, almost cult type religion that I've kind of molded on Christian evangelicalism, especially the evangelicalism that I knew back in the day of, say, like Jesse Helms, which would have been this time. If you don't know who he is, he's a terrible person. You should look him up. Anyhow, she is sent away with this man named Vernon Prophet to a camp. It's a school in the remote Appalachian Mountains called Solid Rock. And she's supposed to be there to be converted to straight. Of course, we all know about the Pray to Gay Away bullshit camps that, you know, they are still in existence in this country. So really, really bad things happen to her. Sexual assault, rape, those kind of things. She meets a young man there named Charles. Charles is autistic. He's there because of something someone else did to him. His youth pastor raped him. Charles is asexual. He's autistic and asexual. And he's just different, and that's his crime. That is it. They just, as long as you don't conform, as long as your gender identity you know, is kind of ambiguous to them, because for him, he just doesn't care, then automatically he's, you know, bad. He's aberrant. He's an abomination.
Right.
Well, the they become friends. Something even worse happens to Naomi. She becomes catatonic. She's severely injured. And he takes care of her for a long time. Eventually, one day, the pastor who likes raping little boys, specifically Charles, because he's going to cure him of it and get the sin out that he wants. Like they call it getting the sin out, because they feel like, oh, well, you know, he just has to ask for forgiveness from God. And it'll teach this boy not to be homosexual, because obviously it's bad. And see, I raped you, how bad it is to be gay. Like, as if that is the same thing as loving sexual relationship. They're just caught up in the physical, you know, act, and they can't understand love and all that. But anyhow, when he's trying to do that, Naomi comes to, she's been to a certain degree, and completely beats the shit out of this guy. Well, they had known beforehand that they had to get away. But there's no way they could get out of the house and get away from the county, because the county is completely isolated and controlled by Solid Rock. I mean, they're essentially the police force. They are the government. And Vernon Prophet is the de facto leader and demigod of Yancey County, North Carolina, which is a real place and a lovely place. This is all fiction. Anyhow, they need is, they want guns, because they have no other way of fighting against these much larger people. Even though Naomi's large, she's still a teenager, and so she's not as strong. And they have guns, you know, because they're nutty, and they're preparing for a holy war. So they're all walking around strapped, and there's a safe in the room of the pastor who's keeping them, or the demigod Vernon Prophet. There's a safe in his bedroom. They break into his bedroom because they have actually been living in his house, because he wants to be directly over them, because they're not really there to be converted. They're there to die and to be tortured before they die, because that's what he's all about. He's a child predator, and he's come up with a way to legitimize him and to be fed children to predate on until he throws them away. There's a safe in there. Charles has overheard the pastor, the cult leader, telling the man who is his rapist the combination and how to do it. And he has an eidetic memory, you know, which is something a lot of autistic people. I'm autistic. I wish I had an eidetic memory. But a lot of us do have. And he recalls it to her. And if the safe doesn't have guns in it, what it has is a manhole cover in the bottom. And then they use a tool. They lift that manhole cover up there's an entire tunnel down there, a staircase. And when they get down there, there's a room full of weapons of war, M16s, grenades, MREs, which are, you know, heat and eat food for military use, water, survival stuff, insane level of illegal firearms, right? They get back upstairs. The man that had tried to hurt Charles reaches out as he walks by and cuts the inside of his leg, severing his femoral artery. As they go down to try to get out, he's bleeding. He doesn't realize how bad he's bleeding. Well, they find another door, because this room is a lit room built into a cavern with concrete and has fluorescent lights, the whole deal. There's an armored door on the other side that's being held shut with a 4x4 piece of wood. And so they take the 4x4 piece of wood, open it up, shine a flashlight down this gorgeous cavern, and is with stalactites coming down from the ceiling, water dripping down from the ceiling, just like marvelously, like translucent water and sparkling granite pieces in these stalactites. I've been in caves like that. That's based on real experience for me. I lived in this area for years in a cabin that was built in the 1800s, where a lot of these ideas came from. So it's just a real experience for me. And as they're walking out, Charles falls dead. And there's nothing she can do about it. So now she's in this cavern on the upside where she just came from. She starts hearing people coming after her. And so she's got to run. And there's only one way she can run. That's into the cavern. And they catch up with her. And a scuffle ensues. She ends up shooting the pastor, but not completely incapacitating him. Like, he doesn't kill him. She blinds him because she hits a piece of his flashlight, ends up lodged in his eye, and she shoots him through the femur, and completely disabling him. But he has a whole party of fanatics chasing after her through the cavern. She goes and runs, and she gets to a dead end. And up until this point in the book, there have been no supernatural beings. Suddenly, there's this puddle at the end, and she thinks she's at a dead end. And what she doesn't realize is that puddle is a underground aquifer. And it leads to this deep underground cave of ice-cold mountain water. And she's afraid to go in because she'll drown. I mean, it's like there's no air in there. You come up and you're just hitting rock. Suddenly she turns around and there's this giant creature, this hairy, tall creature that doesn't talk. It pushes her into the water. And she struggles and almost drowns and drops the gun she used, completely blind now because it had a flashlight on the end of it. Ends up coming up through this small hole into another cavern. In this cavern, it's like a sarcophagus. There are buried girls in these little holes, like cubbies, right? And they're in different states of decay. They're his former victims, which makes her realize that there's another way out of this cave she's in, not just the way she came in through the water, but there's another hole in there. She goes and searches in the dark, finds this other entrance, goes under, comes out into the night in the mountains overlooking a field that she soon realizes is a golf course. She's exhausted. She's freezing. She makes a run for it, starts climbing up the back trails of the mountains and like the back trails of Mount Mitchell, which is the Black Mountains, this huge mountain range. And she gets really tired. The creature helps her. She survives the night. And she ends up at the back door of this couple trying to eat the cabbage out of their garden. And she's afraid of everybody up here because everybody's involved with her. And when they confront her, she tries to run. And she can't. She falls over the fence, trying to jump the fence. And they take her in. And they're a kind couple. And I wanted to make them a Christian couple because I think a lot of people think, well, my books are just anti-Christian. That's not the case. In fact, the people in the book who are the kindest people are they're a couple who's been ostracized by this church because the church wants the leader to be Vernon Prophet. They want their prophecy to be the ultimate word in Christianity in the region. And these folks are very much kind of like Quakers. I don't specifically say they're Quakers, but they are based on a Quaker couple I know. They raise her for a couple of years, teaching her, academics. Both of them are brilliant people. She learns to hunt and to find food and all this stuff, living in this remote cabin. They can't leave because their daughter was killed by the same man, Vernon Prophet, and he has basically blackmailed them by creating false evidence of them doing of them having child porn, because he has some, and he basically made them touch it, and now their fingerprints are on it. There's a long story. I can't go into that because I've already gone too long. Anyway, they show up, they kill them, and she escapes into the woods, ends up hitchhiking with a couple of guys who are pot salesmen. They sell weed, and they end up getting run down by some local wannabe hillbilly gangsters, and she saves them from them, and then she ends up back out in the wide world. But back in the wide world, she can't be her own identity because she's supposedly dead, because the church said long ago that she died when she escaped. What she has is the daughter's identity from the Quaker couple that was given to them by them. And so she creates a false identity masquerading as the daughter. Goes to school, quiet life for quite some time. Eventually, she starts to feel guilty because she knows that he's out there still doing what he's doing. And she starts to wonder, really, is the Mara, who's the large hairy creature, is it real? Is it not real? She's not sure, because she was a starving child. She has no idea. And she begins making plans on taking down Solid Rock. And one by one, she starts picking these people off and killing them in extremely creative and painful ways until she finally gets to Vernon Prophet and finally puts him, not in the ground specifically, you have to find out where she puts him, but right before that happens, you find out that she has reconnected with Tiffany because she took her she had to get together a private investigator to search her out, because Tiffany, her entire story, of course, I'll tell later, she ended up homeless and working as a sex worker and drug addiction because that was the life that she was basically forced into. She's trying to kill the pain with heroin. She's trying to make money doing sex work, and she's living where she can, and horrible things are happening to her. Naomi finds her, breaks into this like flop house is what I call it, where she's strung out with all these other people, picks her up and takes her home, helps her get off, and they dump his body, and there's a supernatural event that allows her to basically take control of the power that the character that I call Mara, who's the large hairy creature, has, and carry that forward. And that's the end of the book. And I know that was probably a lot. And I it's hard to kind of summarize your own work because I want to talk about it for 10 hours because I could give you a little detail. So hopefully that wasn't too much.
It was nice length. And I think that you cover a lot of the, it gives a good catching up for people who don't have any exposure to the book, who haven't read it yet, to kind of get a sense of the flow of the story. And it puts in perspective Naomi's experience as someone who is put into very hard and painful and violent experiences and perseveres through them, survives through all of these dangers, and has revenge on the mind, right? And enacts that revenge, but also has someone that she cares for, that she loves and seeks out to take care of and to protect.
Luke, the story is way better told in the book than me telling it that way. Also, she gives Nazis the only thing Nazis deserve, and that's death. I forgot to mention the Nazis. sorry, I love a dead Nazi in a book. I mean, fuck them. I don't care. So, you know, that's kind of a recurring, I wouldn't say a recurring theme, but it definitely has been a theme in this book and has been a theme in some of my other works that's not published. So, So I forgot the dead Nazi part.
You can't forget about the dead Nazi part.
No, of course not. I don't really want to ruin it, but the book is so worth a read because it does give you the a preload of why Naomi is the way she is at the beginning of Prophet's Lamentation. So Prophet's Lamentation I wrote as a standalone sequel, which I assume that's a thing. If it's not, then I'm taking credit for it. But because Prophet's Debt, the first book, is so graphic, and I mean, it has depictions of rape and molestation and genital mutilation.
Right.
So it's not something that everybody can read. I think it's important because these things really happen, and it should be talked about. I don't think it's talked about enough. I kind of give you the back that there's the way the book starts. You don't have to have her full background. She goes over, you know, and gives it to you as you need it, without it being so jarring and disturbing. Because the situation she finds herself in is not separate from that last situation, but separate enough that it is its own story.
Yeah, I definitely do think that Naomi is in a very different place in Prophet's Lamentation than she was in Prophet's Debt. And, you know, that's part of the nature of, you know, the journey that she took to get to where she was at the end of Prophet's Debt as well. But I do think that the start of Prophet's Lamentation has Naomi being a little bit more of kind of what I think of as a sort of reluctant hero, where she has a struggle with taking up that mantle, is kind of how I view it. Would you agree that characterization of Naomi at the beginning of Prophet's Lamentation?
Yes and no. Because at this point she's not sure that there's anything left to do. What she is like someone who came off the battlefield. And the only life she's known from the time she's 14 is fighting and trying to survive. You know, in the first few lines of the book, say, terror and fury molded me for 11 years. And she doesn't know how to create a normal life for herself. And she feels agitated and unsure and has all this nervous energy left over, even though her task has been complete. And she starts drinking pretty regularly and heavily. And while she's not an abusive spouse by any stretch, she's abusive to her own self. And she hates her own self. And she doesn't feel guilty about killing those people. But she doesn't know who else to be, because that is who she was for so long, and she's very much struggling with her own identity. So when things do happen, she is reluctant for a little bit, but when she has a purpose again that involves what she does best, which is killing these motherfuckers, then she comes back online and really starts to become herself again. So I think she's more of a war-torn hero with no direction. But you're right, momentarily reluctant until, you know, what has to be done has to be done. And I've done that reading, so I'll tell you the part. And another, a lot of reason Naomi's different too is the story starts in 1993, and I pick up, it ends in the first book in 2004. So 11 years pass, and there's 2 years where Naomi and Tiffany are married in Massachusetts, and they're in North Carolina. So at that time, not a valid marriage, but we all know that changes later on. And they're living, and they've done financially well. They stole a whole lot of money from those fucking Nazis, because they were, anyway, you'll find out. Read the fucking book. Anyhow, they go to a nightclub called Spectrum in downtown Wilmington, which is the only gay-friendly nightclub in Wilmington. It's not real. I base it off of another nightclub. I'm not going to give you the name, but I used to go there a bunch. And there's a bar next door that's populated by a lot of Marines called The Helm. And at this time in my life going down there, there was a lot of problems with these Marines coming from Jacksonville. Of course, most of them are not a problem. I don't want everyone to think I'm saying all Marines are like this. My dad's a Marine. But these guys are young, stupid, because they're 20 years old. I was 20 years old one time, and I had really no sense. Strong, fit young men who go out and chase women, sometimes literally. And when that kind of didn't work out, I have been witness to and tried to stop gay bashings. And those things happen on a regular basis. In fact, I based the Claude character off of a young man I know who beat the fucking brakes off of this Marine in the parking lot of this nightclub. And he's this little guy. He's like 5'6". Marine's like 6 feet tall. And he just pummeled him in this parking lot for trying to hurt him, for being a gay man, calling him all sorts of names that I won't repeat. And I was very impressed, as you might imagine. So he wound up in the book. That's actually his, Nate Claude is his actual name. I just don't use his last name. So Naomi stops the gay bashing, and because someone was trying to hurt Claude behind Spectrum. And when this occurs, she's trying not to use her abilities. And one of the men is really large. And inevitably, she has to. And what she does opens up a portal to this place, this horrifying place that she's seen in her dreams, but didn't know it was real or not, and kicks this man through. And he lands there, and this giant creature with like translucent skin with indigo colored blood running through its veins, and like an oblong plump body with long limbs with like spear tip limbs and claws that are like 3 feet long and black, and he has human like teeth in the top of his mouth, but nothing below, no lower jaw, just this flappy, dark gullet, and no eyes, just black holes.
Right.
Screams, comes by, picks him up, runs off with him into the woods as the other Marines watch, and then the portal closes, and that guy's fucking gone. So there's this whole, like, what the hell is this? Where is this place? Holy shit, this is actually real moment for her. And that's when it snapped. And she's like, you know what, motherfuckers? I'm back. And I'm going to be Naomi. And she is for 300 pages. You know, it's to me, like, what I describe this book as is like 95% less suffering, 200% more ass kicking. Because a lot of the first book, 100 and some pages, it's really rough. Horrible things happen to her. She's a little girl. She's helpless. Now she is in peak form and ready to take care of people who are out to hurt the weak, because she used to be the weak. And now she is preys upon those who prey upon the weak.
I'd like to thank you for talking with me today and for being on the Writer's Triangle. And I'm really excited for the release of Prophet's Lamentation. I know your fans are too. And so thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me, Rasta.
And to everybody listening, you know, thank you to all of our beautiful moms for checking in, tuning into the Writer's Triangle. Be sure to buy Prophet's Lamentation, available everywhere books are sold, coming out this upcoming Tuesday. Real quick, Rob, can you share with everybody where they can find you as far as social media?
I lost my first Twitter account because I told Elon Musk that the Matrix was a trans allegory and didn't belong to him. And so now I have a new one. It's Author Creekmore. So like a novelist, Author Creekmore on Twitter. All one word, Author Creekmore.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you for coming on, and thank you, everybody, for listening. Be sure to visit centerbarmoth.com to check out the transcripts, where I also have the links to Rob's Twitter and for links to Prophet's Lamentation and Prophet's Debt. Once again, Rob, thank you for coming on today. It's been wonderful having you.
Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye.